your single family home can now be a 10-story development, and it exponentially increases the value of your land.
Here's a story that's becoming more and more common in certain neighborhoods in Miami.
I have an aunt who lives in Little Haiti, has owned her home, it's probably paid off, and she tells me she gets about 3 or 4 letters a month, right? So if you're a homeowner, especially if you're elderly, you don't really know, and you're being enticed by private investors, developers, you know, a nice dollar to move and sell your home. So you're not really thinking. And the thing is that we don't understand the value of our land.
Developers looking to buy up homes in mostly Black working class communities.
A group of Haitian business owners been in the community for 10, 15, 20 years. They've been paying their rent, but this new developer who rightfully now owns the development, he's not accepting their rent because he has bigger plans. So you're talking about people who rely on their business being there. They're staples in the community. Everyone knows about them, but the reality is that a developer is coming in and he has bigger plans. So what do you do?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, broadcasting all this week from WLRN in Miami. And that's the question we're answering today. What do you do when your community suddenly becomes the most desired by developers confronting sea level rise? Is climate gentrification real?
It is real. Little Haiti is at the intersection of climate gentrification, you know, and immigration.
Residents say climate gentrification is already happening. But to understand why developers started swooping into neighborhoods like Little Haiti and Liberty City, we have to go back to where we began the week, in Miami Beach. The city is right at sea level, and flooding with the semi-annual king tides became so destructive that city officials spent big money to fix it. Part of the solution is this elaborate pumping system that sucks any standing water out from the street and spits it into the ocean.
This looks normal, but this thing here goes into a very active pump.
That's Hal Wanless again, the geologist from the University of Miami, who we heard from earlier this week. He took us around Miami Beach to show us some of the infrastructure the city had installed to handle rising tides and sea levels.
And so these are meant to do what? To pump water?
Any water that comes visible here will immediately go down a drain and disappear. That's the idea.
So no flooding up to the knee?
That's the idea.
Well, you're saying that's the idea. I'm wondering, does it mean that it works?
Well, it failed twice last summer, once during Inez and once during a very heavy rain.
So what happens when it fails?
Well, everything floods. You can see the businesses across the street are quite a bit down from the new street level.
That's right. It's not only drains and pumps. Miami Beach has also raised some of their roads. Look carefully and you'll see stairs or ramps that take you a few feet below street level to all the restaurants and shops. That 6-foot wall around your condo complex, well, now it's only 3 feet above street level.
But what I wanted to show you on the left up here is after they raised the road, they put in all these stairways going down, what is that, 3 feet or 4 feet?
That's amazing.
Down into the entrances to these condominiums.
I should mention here that this part of Miami Beach is relatively wealthy, full of high-rise condos with striking views of the bay and perfectly manicured gardens. The price tag for all this? $500 million. That's billion with a B. And that's just for this small section of the neighborhood.
This doesn't seem like enough at all.
Well, and the question is $500 million for about 30 streets north-south along the coast, maybe 3 blocks inland? That's a very small part of Miami Beach. There are a lot of areas on into the main part of Miami Beach that flood regularly. There is going to come a time when home values will diminish, probably rapidly, and tax base will diminish, probably rapidly. And then it's sort of over for doing these kind of things.
And Hal says when it's over and the sea levels continue to rise, all these people living in Miami Beach, the surrounding islands, low-lying areas in Miami-Dade County, they're all going to have to go somewhere else. And they've already got their eyes set on where that might be. I spent an afternoon in Little Haiti, just a few miles away from the newly fortified Miami Beach. At Northeast 59 Terrace, music was playing as Chef Emmanuel served up quinoa, bean stew, and pickled vegetables from his food stall Via Vegan. But there are also boarded up businesses that have been bought out by developers and an organic chicken market that sits across the street from a traditional Haitian restaurant. Several purple signs advertise Magic City, an expansive complex of apartments and shops that could totally transform the neighborhood. But some people are skeptical.
Marlène Bastien, founder and executive director of FAM, Family Action Network Movement, formerly known as Haitian Women of Miami.
We met Marlène at the Little Haiti Cultural Complex, a community center in the heart of Little Haiti. FAM helps its members with things like immigration issues and social services.
We're also fighting against gentrification. We are fighting against the displacement, the forced displacement and separation of our families, because Little Haiti is at the intersection of climate gentrification, you know, and immigration.
Because here's the thing, right? Climate change or no climate change, Little Haiti has already been gentrifying. And the fact is, it's one of the highest points in Miami, and that's what makes it even more attractive to developers.
It is real. It is real because the prices of real estates are going sky high, because suddenly Little Haiti, which used to be this blighted and depressed area, is believed to be situated 12 feet above sea level, and then it becomes prized land right now. And then so the developers are really getting the prices, you know, beyond limit, and which makes it impossible for people who've lived in the area for years and years to stay. That's what it is. And it is real. It is real.
Marlène called what's happening psychological warfare. Very strong language, to say the least. But to make her point, she told us a story about this man.
He couldn't sleep. He was so scared. The two buildings, you know, on his left and right were purchased. And then people were haunting him, knocking on his door, even on Sundays. And then he became so scared, and he came to our office and said he was afraid to sleep, that he was going to sell, and we convinced him not to sell. So a couple of months later, I saw him. I said, "What happened? I haven't seen you. You were supposed to come back." He said, "Marlène, I just could not sleep. I was afraid for my family, so I had to sell."
This is not an uncommon story. I don't know if all stories are that emotional for some of the homeowners, but for many of these people, these are individuals who don't speak English fluently and almost feel like they're being bullied out.
WLRN reporter Nadege Green reports on social justice issues here in the region, and she knows this community and this story very well. Nadege, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We just described something that sounds predatory. How expansive is this happening? How much is this happening?
So we only know anecdotally right now. Some of the homeowners in the area at community meetings or at a recent protest, even over commercial spaces where Haitian-owned businesses are being pushed out, have recounted their own personal stories, saying that, you know, people have approached me and they want me to sell my house. And after I say no, you expect no to be no and you move on. But it becomes almost like harassment. It's like having a telemarketer show up at your door almost.
And how much of this is really tied to climate change, or is that sort of, you know, the excuse that people are using to buy up more properties?
I think it's a mix. I think around Little Haiti right now, Little Haiti is close to the urban core. The urban core has been developed in a way that it has not been before. So you're seeing like a reverse flight now from the suburbs back into Center City. And so it is in a location that people want to live in. But also climate change has some to do with it. Obviously, if you're a developer, if you're someone who is looking at the trends, right? Little Haiti sits above sea level, high above sea level. And so you're going to take that into consideration, you know, as you consider new development projects, because here in South Florida, that will impact your insurance costs. That could even impact whether or not you get financing for a project, because climate change is real and we're seeing the effects of that.
Tell us about Magic City, because we went to Little Haiti yesterday and saw these signs and, you know, properties that have been bought, these big land plots that were open. What is Magic City? What's behind that?
It is a new development project that is coming up in Little Haiti. And there is another multi-million-dollar development project happening west, also on an archdiocese site of a former Catholic school. And all of these projects are looked at in the community as it's going to change the landscape of the community. It's going to be sort of like what Midtown looks looks like now, right? With high rises and mixed use and commercial spaces, and all of that means change for the neighborhood. And what that also means is, you know, also with new development comes higher cost of living, higher rent cost, whether in a commercial space or residential, is going to go up and has been going up in these communities.
And obviously, we can't talk about gentrification without talking about what we just said, income, money. When we were at Biscayne Bay looking at the pumps and looking at all these fancy and very expensive solutions or temporary solutions that had been put in, I kept thinking, what happens if you're low income? What happens right now if a hurricane hits and you're a low income South Floridian?
So I think here in South Florida, especially when we talk about climate change, much of the conversation is around sea level rise. But in communities that are not impacted by flooding in that same way, you don't really hear the conversation about resiliency being brought into these communities. And it does not mean that they're not impacted. In a catastrophic event, poverty and all of those things become more stark. So after Hurricane Irma, for example, people thought, okay, you guys survived this. There was not major physical damage, right, here in South Florida. But in Miami specifically, in the poorer communities, if you were without power for 2 weeks, if you weren't able to go to work for a week and a half, that had detrimental impact because most of our jobs here are very low income. They're hospitality-based jobs. So if you're a housekeeper, and I spoke to several housekeepers, janitors, and you're an hourly worker and you're off from work for a week and a half because of a hurricane, that's a week and a half paycheck that you're not going to get. And so because people didn't work for 2 weeks, within 3 months, they were facing eviction because you could not make that up.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear from Fabiola in a minute, a young Haitian American entrepreneur who's using real estate investment to keep her community intact. What have you seen that other communities are doing to fight gentrification? Because it seems like it's an unwinnable battle, frankly.
And people are saying it like this. What one of the phrases I heard out in the community is that we're not trying to fight gentrification. We're trying to survive it because it's going to happen. There is no undoing this, right? It's happening. And so in Little Havana, for example, you know, there's a business group that is forming called Que Pasa, where they are trying to stave off the Brickell effect because they're so close to Brickell. People now call parts of Little Havana Brickell West. But with that Brickell West moniker comes Brickell West prices, right? And so you're seeing the renters and people who own businesses there trying to form a collective to speak out and to implore policymakers to help them out.
And is there any political will to help the community maintain and or manage this type of situation? Because frankly, I mean, we hear in New York City, we've been gentrified to, you know, within an inch of our lives. And there's a lot of talk, but I don't see a lot of action.
I think that's comparable here. I think it depends on who you ask. If you ask the politicians, they might say yes. But when you go out into the community, the frustration is that you're not actually seeing that in real life. You're not seeing that play out for your day-to-day life. What has started happening is businesses, as they shutter, are calling press conferences just so people know why they're gone, because they don't want them to know, think that they just disappeared. And they're like, I was here, and I want you guys to remember I was here, but I can no longer afford the rising rent costs. And it becomes this conversation over what is the role of government and private enterprise, and whether or not you can actually create policy and whether or not that policy would even pass, right? But we have not seen that on that level yet.
Nadege Green is the social justice reporter at WLRN. Nadege, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Little Haiti's not the only neighborhood that's changing. Just ask Fabiola Florinville.
Look how quiet and peaceful it looks, but you also see the police, so you already know that this is a different type of neighborhood.
Florinville is CEO of Blueprint Creative Group and a real estate investor. Takeaway producers Dana Roberson and Isabel Angel took a tour of the Liberty City neighborhood with her.
So as you can see, the type of housing, like 3-4 unit type quadplexes that they are already starting to build on. I didn't realize that. Okay. Because I know that they started to knock some of them down.
Florinville sees gentrification all around her, but she's trying to focus on solutions to the issues threatening her neighborhood. She's part of an organization called the Miami Millennial Investment Firm. Its mission? To invest in Black communities like Liberty City and Little Haiti before outside developers come in.
It's a group of millennials who came together. Half of us didn't even know each other. And we decided that instead of, you know, just investing individually as some of us were, myself included, let's create the story of impact. You know, we hear gentrification all the time.
who's really talking about solutions? So we didn't create something, you know, it's been done forever. All we did was just pull together our resources and say, let's do it together. Let's concentrate in a community that we know needs to be preserved culturally, economically as well. And so, I mean, it's business at the end of the day. So we're not saying that we're doing this as a nonprofit. So there's a money component to it, but we're going to be smart and strategic about it.
But doing what? Like, what are you guys doing? Investing?
Yeah. So what we did, we identified properties within Liberty City. That was our target community. So we want to create that critical mass. So it's not just internally, but for us to be peer influencers to other millennials, other young investors, to be inspired to want to replicate the same model. So we pulled together our money. We came up with a little under $150,000 in cash, and we purchased a couple of properties, started off that way. We renovated them, and we had a very serious conversation with housing agencies here that's, you know, we know that legally you can't, you know, restrict your houses to certain buyers, but we made it very clear that we have a mission. You know, we're here looking for cultural preservation as well. We know that there's a pipeline of buyers who want to be able to own their own homes. They want that same American dream that everyone has, but they can't afford to live in Miami. That's the reality. Miami is just not affordable for the average person. And so we're pricing our homes under that $200,000 mark so that we can get that first-time home buyer, whether it's a single mom, a young couple, a young professional who cannot purchase a typical home, but is willing to live in the Liberty City and a Little Haiti. So the challenge is that oftentimes, you know, we hear of crime, we hear of communities being blighted. And so we get scared of our own communities, right? And so we run away, but then investors see it totally different. They'll look at the diamond in the rough and say, it's within 5 miles of downtown. You know, we can probably change zoning codes. It's on higher ground. We know in 10 years, climate change and gentrification is going to be a big topic. Let's set our sights there. So private investment, you can't stop, right? We need some level of private investment, but let's also do some type of social impact investing as well. And so that's what we did.
But how do you do that when, I mean, let's be honest, the forces of private investment, the forces of gentrification, the forces that are saying, you know what, we're going to take this and rezone this, you know, without really a lot of people understanding what's happening. How do you compete with developers and investors at that level? I mean, can you realistically do that?
Well, no, you can't compete against cash, right? But you can rally the community around you, right? So we were creating this story. First of all, know the value of your land, right? We live in Liberty City where everyone is saying it's bad. No, we can change our community the way we want it to change. We can bring in retail. We can bring in commercial. Keep your homes. Invest in your homes. Actually, move back into the community. And there's a pocket within Liberty City where you still have the original homeowners. It's that old black money, right? They've been there for a while. Lawyers, judges, teachers, and they're well organized. So when you talk about the Hadley Park Association, even though crime may be happening all the way around them and investments, you know, Hadley, do not touch Hadley, right? Because they respect their organized rules to their section and they protect their investment. We need to replicate that, right? So it's educational. So what we did when we came together, we started to create this theme around the value of Liberty City, the value of Overtown, the value of Little Haiti, North Miami, Miami Gardens, all black cities. Miami Gardens is having the Super Bowl in 2020 because that's where Hard Rock Stadium is. The Miami Tennis Open is moving from Key Biscayne downtown to Miami Gardens, an all black city, the largest black city south of Atlanta. We need to protect our investment now because the face of it is going to change as investment comes in, and we can't stop investment, but what we can do is participate. And so that was our story. Let's participate in it. So they can do what they want to do, but let's also get involved and participate.
What does someone do? Someone who might be in foreclosure and they get a letter and they say, hey, you know, would you be interested in selling this home? Like, how do you get that message out to people, number one? And number two, what should homeowners do if they feel that they're being pressured?
So as an example, what I tell my aunt, if you ever feel like you need to sell the home, sell it to us, sell it to me. I mean, I have plenty of cousins. We're all educated. We're all doing well. Sell it to us. Keep it in the family for one. But for others, it's educational. So with climate change, gentrification being the hot topic right now, there's been a lot of community organizations that's been rallying the Haitian community to let them know, you know, they're making it culturally sensitive to them, but they're educating them as well. You know, this is Little Haiti. We need to keep it. Little Haiti just went through a name change, right? Which is significant because it wasn't an official name for the area. It was just coined Little Haiti as the migration of Haitians came in and, you know, flourished the community. So we need to value that. But just even from a community level, when we came together to create our investment, even in my personal investments, I'm investing right now in Jacksonville in historic Springfield, which is a historic Black community that's also going through gentrification. What we try to do is pair ourselves with first-time home buyers. So the county and various agencies grant up to $80,000 in first-time home buyer loans. So we go directly to those agencies where we know they have a pipeline of buyers, usually from these communities, and I say it explicitly, I want someone who knows the community, who is comfortable with the community, who is probably a product of the community, and generally they're going to be Black. And so that's how you can tailor it. If we really want to say, let's take care of the people, there are ways to do it legally, right? We know organizations who already have members of the community as part of their pipeline, right? So if you want to develop in Little Haiti and Liberty City, but you also want to be conscious about your development, there's Little Haiti Housing CDC, where you can find buyers who are ready and willing. They've gone through the program. They have the funding. There's no homes for them. And that's a problem. So you have a pipeline of buyers, but no homes because nothing's affordable. And so when we're doing redevelopment in our communities, we have to think about affordability as well. So everyone's talking about affordable housing, but then you have that pocket who's left out. So we need to think about mixed income housing. We need to think about more inclusive communities. How do we get most of Miami, not the lower bottom, but the middle as well, to participate in what's happening?
Fabiola Florinville, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Fabiola Florinville is CEO of Blueprint Creative Group.
Hey, this is Amber. I'm a producer here at The Takeaway. Wait, don't fast forward. This will just take 30 seconds, I promise. This Friday with Amy Walter, we're exploring work requirements for government assistance programs, and we want your take. Do you think people who receive government benefits like food stamps or Medicaid should be required to work a minimum number of hours? Let us know. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. See? 30 seconds. No big deal. Now here's your podcast back.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today marks the 50th anniversary of the death of presidential candidate and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. But years before his father's death and before the death of his uncle, President John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. lived the charmed life of American political royalty. He joined us recently to talk about it.
Our home when we grew up, you know, it was the satellite White House, and many of the great battles of the Kennedy administration were orchestrated from there. Our home was filled with cabinet officials, civil rights leaders, but also with Soviet spies, with CIA spies, with Cuban guerrillas from the Bay of Pigs invasion. And we had the Green Berets doing maneuvers on our roof. And then, of course, there was all the cultural leaders and the movie stars and astronauts and athletes who were all part of this circus at Hickory Hill.
Hickory Hill was the Kennedy family home, located just outside of the nation's capital in McLean, Virginia. But despite the family's popularity, the Kennedys also had a troubled relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency, which was run at the time by Alan Dulles, the CIA's longest-serving director to date.
My uncle, President Kennedy, came into office. He already had a very antagonistic relationship with Dulles. And Dulles actually arranged the murder of the Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba days before my uncle took office because he knew that my uncle would not allow it.
The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro.
And then the Bay of Pigs invasion occurred 2 months later. My uncle said during that invasion that he wanted to take the CIA and shatter it into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And he fired Alan Dulles, he fired General Cabell, and he fired Richard Bissell. to three top leaders of the clandestine services.
Robert Kennedy's son told me his father shared a similar disdain for the CIA.
My father, a week before he was killed, told it, and when he had pulled ahead in the California primary, it was clear that he had a very good chance of ending up in the White House, and he started thinking about governance. Told his staff that one of the first things that he was going to do when he became president was to remove the clandestine services from the CIA. And the CIA continued to maintain a antipathy toward my family that went up into the 1980s.
But those plans all changed in the early hours of the morning of June 5th, 1968.
So I thank all of you who made this possible this evening. All of the effort that you made and all of the people whose names I haven't mentioned.
The 42-year-old candidate had just celebrated winning California's Democratic presidential primary. He delivered his victory speech from the embassy ballroom of the Los Angeles Ambassador Hotel.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago and let's win there. Thank you.
Moments later, he'd been shot.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? No! Is that possible?
It could be.
Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another man, a Kennedy campaign manager, and possibly shot in the head. I am right here. Rafer Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot.
24-year-old Sirhan B. Sirhan was captured at the scene with a .22 caliber revolver in his hand.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
That evening, President Lyndon Johnson addressed the nation.
200 million Americans did not strike down Robert Kennedy last night, any more than they struck down President John F. Kennedy in 1963 or Dr. Martin Luther King in April of this year. But those awful events give us ample warning that in a climate of extremism, of disrespect for law, of contempt for the rights of others, violence may bring down the very best among us.
At his trial in 1969, Sirhan Sirhan admitted that he shot Kennedy, though he later claimed to have no memory of the act. He was originally sentenced to death, later commuted to life in prison, and is currently approaching 50 years behind bars. But all these years later, RFK Jr. isn't convinced that Sirhan is responsible for his father's death.
Paul Schrade, who was one of my father's closest friends and who was shot in the head the night that my father was shot, and actually received, was shot by the first of Sirhan's bullets, the two bullets that went in my father's direction. One of them hit Paul Schrade, and Paul has maintained for many, many years that my father was not killed by Sirhan. There was five other people who were shot by Sirhan besides Paul, but that the bullets that killed my father actually came from behind, according to Thomas Noguchi's autopsy, which is called in the literature the perfect autopsy. The gun was actually touching his body. They were contact shots when those four shots were fired, and Sirhan was always in front of my father and was 3 to 5 feet in front of him, and there were 77 eyewitnesses, and nobody saw him behind him.
Since 1974, Schrade, a former aide to Robert Kennedy, has maintained that there was a second gunman on the scene, RFK Jr., who visited Sirhan Sirhan last year in the California State Prison Complex where he was being held, has come to believe that Schrade is right.
You know, this is an area that I've never wanted to get into, that, but Paul has maintained for many years that the wrong person was convicted of the crime, and that my father, who was the chief law enforcement officer of the land, would be deeply disturbed that somebody had been wrongly convicted of a crime. And he persuaded me after many years to sit down and read the autopsy reports and read the other police reports and the other evidence. And I ended up talking to many of the people who were eyewitnesses that night and came to the conclusion that the crime ought to be reinvestigated.
But talking about what might have happened or what history may have gotten wrong is painful for the son that carries his father's name.
You know, my mother's about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of my father's death, and I'm not, I don't want to, I've had invitations from every news organization to come in and talk about this issue, and I've said no to everybody. So I don't want to go down that road with you.
50 years later, what moves him is the memory of his father that so many Americans still keep alive.
I get reminders of it almost on a daily basis from people who come up to me in airports and on the street or at speeches and said, you know, I became a nurse because of your father. I went into public service. Or I ran for mayor. Or people like yesterday, a producer from a TV show who told me that her name was Carrie Kennedy and that she had been born right after my father died and named for my baby sister.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another. Feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Robert F. Kennedy, killed 50 years ago today. There she is, Miss America, your ideal. It's long been a competition that's synonymous with physical beauty, but apparently no more. That's if you believe Miss America chair Gretchen Carlson. On Tuesday, Carlson announced that Miss America would drop its swimsuit competition and will no longer judge women on their physical appearance. That's a big deal for a few reasons. The swimsuit portion of the competition has been around since the very first Miss America pageant back in 1921. Cutting it entirely is just one of a series of changes for an organization that's had a pretty rough year. We asked Nina Davaluri for her take on all this. She's Miss America 2014 and the first Indian American to win the competition.
Oh my goodness, the swimsuit competition was my biggest challenge and biggest hurdle for a few different reasons, actually. And I think the largest barrier for me to even enter or participate in the competition was because of the swimsuit component, which is really unfortunate because it's actually the lowest weighted portion of competition. And so, unfortunately, there's still a significant amount of emphasis, even though, you know, walking in a swimsuit and heels isn't easy by any stretch.
And, no, I've done it. It's difficult.
Right. You get it.
Yes, yes.
And so, for me, you know, I'd struggled with my weight my entire life, struggled with an eating disorder that I've spoken openly about. And also there was this cultural component. I was the first South Asian and Indian American to win the title of Miss America. And I grew up in a very conservative South Asian family. So this was just a really difficult part of the process in competing for Miss America. And I just remember watching this, growing up watching this, feeling like I could never be in this role because I, you know, didn't have a certain body type by any stretch. You know, I wasn't white and my talent was very different. So I was a very out of the, you know, box Miss America, I suppose. But I'm also very grateful for the opportunity because I was able to still break that stereotype and perception of the organization.
So we're hearing that this is really going to be not about a candidate's outward appearance. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been in a pageant. You won the biggest pageant. Let's be honest. Even taking away the swimsuit competition, is that really going to mean we're going to see larger bodies, different types of people? Mm-hmm. Because you can take away a swimsuit, but that doesn't mean you don't still have to be a size 2.
I certainly hope that this is really the next push towards inclusivity in terms of bodies, in terms of race, ethnicity, religious, orientation. I think one of the things that I realized even during my travels as Miss America and beyond, my platform was diversity and cultural competency. And so speaking with colleges and university-aged young women and demographics, and men actually, but specifically the women who were interested in competing, so many of them would say, you know, I'd really do it if there wasn't a swimsuit competition because of my background, because of my religious beliefs, or because of my cultural upbringing. And so I think there's also this component that we've been missing, that there are young women, not only in that realm, but who are qualified, who are, you know, champions in their communities, who are service-oriented, who simply don't compete because of this emphasis on beauty. And I think we're going to see a significant change in that. And I think, unfortunately, what people don't see is that there's that one night on television where Miss America is telecast, and you see us walking around in these swimsuits and gowns, and people don't understand what Miss America does necessarily the next 364 days out of the year.
Well, what do you do? I mean, I think people think, okay, Miss America, you win the pageant, and you get to do what exactly?
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And I think we're trying to change that perception of that one night of the telecast. And so Miss America, the night you win, you are immediately thrown into a press conference. You start your press and media tour, and you're promoting your platform. You know, I mentioned mine was diversity, cultural competency, but every contestant who competes is required to have a personal platform, a cause that they choose to champion for their year of service. And so in addition to that, they also serve as an ambassador for Children's Miracle Network Hospitals, and to continue traveling and touring as a role model and as a spokesperson for you know, young women. And I think that's been extremely lost in translation because of that stereotype and perception of a beauty pageant, which is such an archaic notion. And if Miss America wants to continue to stay relevant, we need to continue to evolve.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, right? It's known as a beauty pageant, right? So mm-hmm. The emphasis is obviously, I think for a lot of people, is on looks. I was in a pageant, you know, forever ago, and they decided to change the pageant to call it a cultural pageant. But at the same time, we still had to wear bathing suits. We still had to look really pretty. We all were the same size. In this era of Me Too, where do we see pageants like this fitting in?
I think that we're not going to see this change happen really until the year after. This was announced very quickly, or I should say suddenly. And so right now, this year's group of candidates is still competing in the swimsuit competition at their state competitions. So majority of the state competitions really take place between May and July, and then Miss America takes place in September. So I think next year, once this announcement now has been made, we're really going to see a huge influx of new young women who are competing, who are embracing that, you know what, here's an organization for me who's actually walking their talk and saying what they believe in, and really removing the swimsuit portion of this. And by us saying, you know what, we've always been a scholarship and service-oriented program, and now we're actually showing that's really what we care about.
How can we really move this organization forward? Because it does, I mean, there were, before Gretchen Carlson took over, there were, you know, these emails, these pretty lewd emails that came to light about people in the highest levels of the organization sort of picking apart contestants. I mean, is this really a new day?
I absolutely think it is a new day. One of the most poignant moments that I remember actually was right after this had come out with these emails. And I think so many of the sisterhood or people involved in the organization were really shocked. And so as former Miss Americas, you know, one of the best things that we can do is organize and, you know, take action. And so that's exactly what all of us did. So many of us were involved in the election, and actually we all elected Gretchen Carlson as chairwoman of the board, all the former Miss Americas. And we elected the three other Miss Americas who serve on the board of directors now. So I do think that we are in a place where we are advocating for ourselves and really trying to change what we understand the job of Miss America to be and really putting that forth to the public.
Nina Davaluri is a speaker, advocate, and Miss America 2014. Nina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been hearing from you. What do you think of beauty pageants in 2018?
Hi, this is Michelle calling from Honolulu. I believe all these pageants and beauty contests are irrelevant and indeed damaging to the average girls, who probably feel that they will never measure up because in reality, it's all about physical beauty. No one is parading a beautiful woman for her brains.
Hi, this is Julie from Duluth, Minnesota. I believe the Miss America pageants offer a negative value to our culture and diminish the value of women.
Name is Frank from Westbury, New York. America itself is portraying a very bad image globally. Miss America is a reflection of that image. So at the moment, I do not think it is a positive or a good thing.
Hi, this is Kate. I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Pageants like these put worthless billionaires in the limelight and get stroke their ego enough so that they think they should run for president.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Williams, and I'm calling from suburban Chicago. So-called beauty pageants that take themselves seriously are disgraceful. Think about it this way. How would you like to look at a bunch of men in Speedos parading on a stage in front of an audience? It's just cringeworthy.
And we got this message from Ramsey, New Jersey, quote, I did participate in beauty pageants as a teenager. It was a positive experience for me. It showed me how much poise I had. Want to share your thoughts with us? Just give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. The lines are always open 24/7. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, broadcasting from WLRN this week with the help of the Miami Foundation. And this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.